Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's gonna hate you. And she's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
It's almost 52 years so far. The world has become a worse and worse place. Every year we have polluted more water.
Welcome to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This March 15th, 2016 edition, episode 81 of Nature Bats Last, comes to you live from the Mud Hut in southern New Mexico. Big thanks to Afrozen for his theme song contribution. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. We are joined today by you, our listeners. This is a call-in show. Please prepare those questions and get ready to give us a toll-free call at 888-874-4888. I'm also joined today by Professor James H. Fetzer. Dr. Fetzer is Professor Emeritus at the University of Minnesota in Duluth. He graduated magna cum laude in philosophy at Princeton University in 1962, where his senior thesis on the logical structure of explanations of human behavior won the Dickinson Prize. After being commissioned a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps, he became an artillery officer and served in the Far East. After a tour supervising recruit training in San Diego, he resigned his commission as captain to begin graduate work in the history and philosophy of science at Indiana in 1966. He completed his PhD with a dissertation on probability and explanation in 1970. Dr. Fetzer's initial faculty appointment was at the University of Kentucky, where he received the first Distinguished Teaching Award presented by the student government. Since 1977, he has taught at a wide range of institutions of higher learning, including the Universities of Virginia twice, Cincinnati, North Carolina at Chapel Hill, New College of the University of South Florida, and now the Duluth campus of the University of Minnesota, where he served from 1987 until his retirement in 2006. His honors include a research fellowship from the National Science Foundation and the Medal of the University of Helsinki. In 1996, he became one of the first 10 faculty members at the University of Minnesota to be appointed a Distinguished McKnight University Professor. According to a rather generic description at Wikipedia, Dr. Fetzer is interested in alleged government conspiracies since the 1963 assassination of U.S. President John F. Kennedy. He also said the 2002 airplane crash that killed U.S. Senator Paul Wellstone was an assassination. Fetzer alleged the 9/11 attacks were treason and called for military overthrow of President George W. Bush. In 2005, with Stephen E. Jones, Fetzer co-founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth, and he has asserted that the World Trade Center buildings were collapsed by controlled demolitions or by high-tech weaponry. Thanks for joining us at Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network, Professor Jim Fetzer.
Yeah, my pleasure. Wikipedia gutted my entry, which was like three times as long. They had twice as much about my conspiracy research, as they call it, on JFK, 9/11, Wellstone, Sandy Hook, the Boston bombing, even a section on the Holocaust. But after I participated in a conference on academic freedom that included discussion of JFK, 9/11, and the Holocaust, it was gutted, two-thirds of it was removed. So fortunately, I had a recent copy, and I published an article where you can evaluate for yourself how Wikipedia functions as a Zionist op when it comes to political issues at James Henry Fetzer Wikipedia, the free encyclopedia, busted.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. They only gutted two-thirds of yours. They took down my entry three times. Three people posted Wikipedia entries about me, and they were each removed within a week. I didn't even see any of them. I just heard about them secondhand. So
right,
Wikipedia is not interested.
Their claims about being open to editing entries are simply false and misleading. For example, they had a history of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, which I founded. And when I sought to correct it five different times, my entries were erased. And eventually I had contact with the editor and I said, "You're not going to let me change it, are you?" And he said, "No," very candidly. I talk about that at the beginning of the busted article, which I think everyone would find highly illuminating.
Again, listeners, we're taking your calls for today's show. The toll-free number is 888-874-4888. Jim, much of your work focuses on so-called conspiracy theories. That term was promulgated by the United States Central Intelligence Agency in 1967, specifically to disparage people such as yourself who point out obvious lies. What's your take on how you and other truth tellers have been treated by the federal government and the media?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, it was intended to belittle critics of the government. I mean, that's a proper understanding of the phrase. If you're a conspiracy theorist or so-called, that's because you're pointing out inadequacies in the government's position about some significant issue. In my case, it began with JFK. Where I brought together experts on different aspects of the case and published three books, which had the effect of shattering the cover-up. We discovered the official autopsy x-rays had been altered to conceal a massive blowout to the back of the head. Another had been altered by adding a 6.5-millimeter metallic slice to implicate this obscure World War II Italian weapon known as the humanitarian rifle for never harming anyone on purpose, that the backyard photographs, one of which was published on the cover of Life magazine to implicate Lee Oswald in the crime, was a fabrication. When it comes to 9/11, by the way, there's a recent 2-hour on 9/11, who was responsible and why, can be found online at The Real Deal. This is my new video show a year and a few months ago. Beginning of 2015, I switched from radio at radiofetzer.blogspot.com to video at The Real Deal, brought by Media Broadcasting Center. And you can find this piece if you search for The Real Deal, episode number 103, 9/11, Who is Responsible and Why, which I did with Dennis Camino, who was the Navy's top electronics troubleshooter before he left the Navy and went to work for Raytheon.
Before we move on to a specific example, you're clearly questioning the dominant narrative in each of several cases that you report upon. So let's back up a little bit. Will you tell us how you proceed in a general sense with each case? I mean, you must have a general approach that you use. Treating each case differently.
Yes, I've outlined it several places. I'm an expert on and have published many books on the nature of scientific knowledge and scientific reasoning, the theoretical foundations of computer science, artificial intelligence, cognitive science, evolution, and intelligence. I'd published 24 books before my retirement in 2006, and I've now published the three volumes on JFK, the co-authored book on Wellstone's death, the first book from scholars on the 9/11 conspiracy, and now in the last 10 months, three new books. And I suppose we didn't go to the moon either, 2015, which discusses the moon landing hoax, the death and replacement of Paul McCartney, the first death of Saddam Hussein, the second death of Osama bin Laden, and the official narrative of the Holocaust, which cannot be sustained on empirical or scientific ground. The second is nobody died at Sandy Hook, where I brought together 13 experts, including six PhD, current or retired college professors. We established that the school had been closed by 2008 it was loaded with asbestos and other biohazards, suffered from hurricane damage. It wasn't in conformity with Americans for Disability Act requirements. The boilers weren't working. It had been abandoned so long there was no heat coming up from the building on a day when the ground temperature was 28 degrees Fahrenheit. So they took an abandoned school, conduct an exercise. It was actually the second day of a two-day FEMA drill where we have the manual, which I published as a first appendix in the book, and then it was done to promote gun control. Obama signed no less than 23 executive orders to constrain our access to weapons on 16 January 2013, that's just a month and 2 days later. Two examples of my approach to conspiracy theories, and I'll give you a third, are the article Reasoning About Assassinations, where I explain the methodology of applying scientific reasoning to take conspiracy theories from theories in the weak sense of being rumors, guesses, or speculations to theories in the strong sense of being empirically testable, explanatory hypotheses. That paper, where I explain how simply by establishing where JFK was hit in the back, which actually was 5.5 inches below the collar just to the right of the spinal column, a shallow shot that only went in about as far as your second knuckle, had no point of exit, you can prove that the existence of a conspiracy involving multiple shooters in the assassination. And that's a paper I presented at Cambridge during an international conference and then published in an international peer-reviewed journal. I put it online. You can download it, Reasoning About Assassinations. Also, the first essay I included in the 9/11 conspiracy, published in 2007, is entitled Thinking About Conspiracy Theories, 9/11 and JFK. And that's where I go through a thumbnail sketch of what I just mentioned here about taking conspiracy theories from the weak sense to the strong, and how the basic principle involved here is known as inference to the best explanation, which entails comparing alternative hypotheses with respect to if they were true, what would be the probability of the available evidence. And when you compare, for example, that Oswald was the lone gunman versus that it was a conspiracy and a cover-up, well, once you know that the autopsy x-rays had been altered, that a 6.5-millimeter slice had been added, that the weapon was a humanitarian rifle in World War II, that the backyard photographs had been faked, the probability that it was bona fide, as the government told us, that Lee Oswald was a lone assassin approaches zero, and the probability that it was, in fact, a conspiracy and a cover-up grows very strong. There's a great deal more evidence you can find there. More recently, by the way, when I was interviewed by the BBC, and they sought to belittle conspiracy theorists in general, I don't think they were very successful. But I took the pre-interview I had and created where I was being grilled about why I was a conspiracy theorist and turned it into a separate YouTube entitled Why I, Jim Fetzer, Am a Conspiracy Theorist. So there are three resources that will give you a very good idea about the use of the term as an instrument of propaganda in order to attempt to belittle or trivialize Americans who are attempting to figure out the truth about areas where the government does not want you to know.
Thanks, and our listeners can find all that information at jamesfetzer.blogspot.com. That's jamesfetzer, F-E-T-Z-E-R.blogspot.com. We have a caller. Greg from California, are still with us?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, fire away.
Well, you know, conspiracy theory seems to be a lot like abrupt climate change. It's real easy to deny and spin. But unlike conspiracy theory, abrupt climate is getting to where it's going to be hard to deny. I'm just, you know, what does it take? Like in conspiracy theory, 9/11, JFK, neither were enough to make anybody revolt, but what's coming with the weather might. Will you agree?
I'm not quite sure your point. Could you reiterate the key point here, Greg?
Well, conspiracy theory, how bad is it going to be before people react or agree or revolt?
I mean, how much evidence do you have to have before you recognize that it's a conspiracy theory? That the government's lying to us? Is that what you mean? Yeah.
Well, I mean, how bad's it going to get? I know what's coming with the rub climate is going to get so bad that it'll be hard to deny.
I get it. The psychologists describe the phenomenon known as cognitive dissonance, which is a tendency to repress or deny information that threatens your core beliefs. An illustration would be a woman who discovers evidence that her husband is molesting their daughter. Years later, when the truth comes out, she's at a loss to explain why she couldn't do anything about it. I think this is true in the case of 9/11, not so much in the case of JFK, because many initial reaction to the death of John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas, was that Lyndon was behind it. Their initial reaction turns out to be 100% correct. I have explained this many times. I've chaired or co-chaired 5 different national conferences on JFK, most recently in Santa Barbara in 2013, which you can find online, JFK at 50, The Assassination of America, with 6 different speakers, and lay out the evidence. 9/11, however, seems to pose a whole lot more emotional resistance, because the very idea that our government would murder 3,000 of our fellow citizens to promote a political agenda seems so far-fetched initially. And it's only when you get into the evidence, such as I propose everyone in doubt review on the Real Deal episode 103, 9/11, who is responsible and why, that you begin to understand what actually happened, where 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons, and the Department of Defense, most of whom had come from the Project for a New American Century and were dual U.S.-Israeli citizens and the Mossad. In fact, there's reason to believe that the destruction of the World Trade Center was outsourced to the Mossad, and that it was done using a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes. Now, I'm engaged in putting together yet a new book for Moon Rock Books. Those last 3 books I mentioned are available for moonrockbooks.com, and I'm putting together a new one on 9/11, which I expect to be the next that will be published in our series, where I'm bringing together the best people on different aspects of the case, so that, you know, I mentioned in Sandy Hook, if you go back to my stuff on JFK, I had a world authority on the human brain who was also an expert on wound ballistics, a PhD in physics, who was also an MD, board certified in radiation oncology, which is a treatment of cancer using X-ray therapy, so it was an expert in the interpretation of X-rays, a physician who was actually in trauma room number 1 when JFK's moribund body was brought in, and 2 days later responsible for the care and treatment of his alleged assassin, a legendary photo and film analyst, another PhD in physics, this time with expertise in the electromagnetism, the properties of light and of images of moving objects. So what I'm doing is bringing the best people on different aspects of the case, where I regard one of my great strengths to be that I know what I do not know. If I need an expert in a given field, for example, in relation to 9/11, I consulted with an aeronautical engineer to address the official trajectory of flight 77, a Boeing 757 ostensibly approaching the Pentagon, which I knew was completely wrong. But he wrote for me a wonderful article explaining how the official approach of this plane barely skimming the ground at over 500 miles an hour and taking out a series of lampposts was preposterous, because the laws of aerodynamics require that that plane at that speed could not get closer to the ground than 60 or even 80 feet, where 80 feet is higher than the Pentagon is tall, because of what's known as ground effect or downdraft. So, you know, this is a sort of thing I've done throughout. In fact, in relation to the 9/11 airplane crash sites, where I had established evidence that all 4 of them had been fabricated or faked, albeit in different ways, I invited General Major General Albert Stubblebine, U.S. Army retired, who was formerly in charge of all U.S. military signals and photographic intelligence, to a two-hour interview with me in which I went through the evidence explaining how each of the crash sites had been fabricated or faked. And the general not only agreed but added additional reasons why I was correct. You can find that show on The Real Deal, episode number 100, the 9/11 crash sites with Major General Albert Stubblebine. So I go out of my way to get experts on different aspects of the case, and I've continued to do that to this day.
Mario from California, you're still with us. Do you have a question for us?
Yes. Thank you so much. There's so much to digest, Aaron. I really want to welcome Guy McPherson to California, particularly the South Toledo Mammal Center in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's a wonderful place to visit where they address a lot of the issues around the acidification of the ocean, the Pacific Ocean, and what the mammals are going through. It's a beautiful place to visit. Also, I wanted to ask Guy kind of what his approach, particularly the conspiracy I think that exists in this country as far as how people are alienated through the educational process and through capital from how it alienates morality from epistemology, particularly getting to these truths, and what Guy does to keep kind of a steady scientific trajectory towards getting to the truths around abrupt climate change and the history of this country. I think, you know, we're living in a time now where there's a lot of ferment and questioning as far as the ingredients of American apple pie. You know, there's a presidential candidate who's, you know, talking about genocide and how different countries are being destabilized by essentially promoting fundamentalism and bringing down secular systems and governments throughout the world. So I think it's a very exciting time to be around. I appreciate Guy McPherson's approach towards science and living in harmony with the earth and that. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Mario, for the welcome and also for the question. I'll be brief because I want to try to keep the focus here on our guest. I wrote an entire book about the indoctrination that passes for the K-12 public education system and beyond, and it's called Letters to a Young Academic Seeking Teachable Moments, I think. It's been a few years, but it's pretty obvious that there's no conspiracy on that front. The people pulling the strings of empire reported in a U.S. Senate report in the late 1800s that the goal was to make Americans not smart enough to question the system, but smart enough to keep the system going so that the people who are most likely to benefit from the system have a bunch of wage slaves at their disposal. So moving on to our guest, Jim, do you report information more freely now than you did when you were an active faculty member? Did you self-censor then? Do you self-censor now? If not, how did you manage to avoid that?
I got myself in trouble by being outspoken in relation to departmental politics at Kentucky, where I received the first Distinguished Teaching Award. I had 13 articles in excellent journals, more than any other assistant professor considered for tenure. I'd given talks at 12 different departments in the first 5 years I was there, which is extraordinary because my work is so interdisciplinary. But I'd opposed a department chair who wanted to have a PhD program. We had a master's program that was very nice, working very well, producing, you know, taking students from a lack of qualification for admission to a PhD program to qualification for admission to a PhD program. I thought that was a useful function for the University of Kentucky to fulfill. I was put in charge of the logic courses for all of our undergraduates, where the fellow who had taught them in the past, who had supervised them in the past, had always explained that he got terrible course evaluations because it was such an intrinsically difficult subject. But I succeeded. We were turning out hundreds of little logicians at the University of Kentucky. I had some great grad students. So they studied with me and then did their thing with their students. And the third of the six tenured faculty who split 3-3 on my tenure was a fellow who graduated from Harvard in 1941 and who explained after I was gone to another faculty member that he voted against me because I was living with my girlfriend without the benefit of marriage. I mean, these three denied me tenure. I wound up spending 10 years on a succession of visiting appointments, as Guy has mentioned, as you have mentioned, Guy, including Virginia twice. Virginia immediately hired me as visiting associate professor, where Virginia at the time was the most distinguished public university in the country. It may still be. They would later bring me back as visiting full professor. By the way, they did eventually get that PhD program at Kentucky, and the last evaluation I saw was that of 96 PhD programs in philosophy, the University of Kentucky ranked dead last. So they can account that a great victory for them. I wound up at a certain point in 1986-87 entering a program for PhDs in philosophy and linguistics who wanted to study computer science and artificial intelligence. And that apparently made me very, very interesting to a lot of departments, because the year before I'd had 7 interviews for positions all junior. That year I had 7 interviews for positions all senior. And within months I was hired as full professor with tenure at the University of Minnesota on the Duluth campus and walked in the front door.
We have another caller, Les from Oregon. Are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm here. I didn't know this was going to be the topic of the show, well, with your guests, I was going to call in with this question anyway, so it's prescient. But apparently, Edward Snowden has come out and said that climate change is a hoax and a conspiracy promulgated by the CIA. And I just wonder, Guy, if you and your guests could talk about that a little bit, if you know anything about it.
This is the first I've heard about it. I'm a little surprised, actually, because Edward Snowden has been straightforward, as near as I can tell, in telling what others won't tell and in being truthful about it. But climate change is a hoax promulgated by the CIA. I don't know if you've seen, but 2015, the warming of the planet was accounted for 20% of the warming in the last 100 years. And the first 2 months of 2016 have broken records. January broke the all-time record, and that record was not just broken. It was shattered by the February record. So if climate change is a hoax or a conspiracy, somebody hasn't told the satellites yet. And the instrumentation record of various forms at this point. So I must say I'm a little surprised about that. Jim, do you have a comment?
Well, I have long regarded Edward Snowden as a national hero for not only revealing the massive spy programs, which others had sought to do, but with documenting them so it was no longer deniable that our own government was conducting this massive surveillance over our emails, our phone calls today, our financial and medical records included. I've always had trouble sorting out the climate change issue. It seemed to me virtually impossible that we could have been dumping pollution into the atmosphere since the 1850s, the Industrial Revolution, and not have environmental or ecological effects. So I've always been inclined to suppose that climate change necessarily was taking place and indeed was affected by contributions from man of the kind I'm describing. I know it's been fiercely contested, and I too am puzzled at Edward Snowden's suggestion that it actually is a conspiracy or theory advanced by the CIA. Do we have an explanation, Les, for why the CIA would want to advance a climate change theory that was false?
I think Les has gone away at my request, so I don't think he's going to answer that unless he calls back.
Do you have any thoughts of your own guy?
Well, I'm looking at an article now at Before It's News, which may not be the most reliable source, indicating that the headline is Shocking New Snowden Confession, Climate Change is a Hoax by the CIA. So apparently at least one source out there is reporting that Snowden is saying that the whole thing is made up by the CIA. So I'm not going to go into any detail.
I mean, when you have documented empirical evidence of climate warming, that the temperature of Earth is higher in successive years, I think if you were to aggregate the last 20 or 30 years, and it's much higher than it had been in previous 20 or 30-year intervals, it's very difficult to deny that there's empirical evidence to substantiate it, which makes it more and more puzzling why it would be described as a conspiracy theory.
Right. That seems very, very questionable to me, and it is completely inconsistent with Snowden's information that he's kicked out so far. So color me confused at this point, and we'll try to do a little further digging beyond Before It's News, which, again, is not a particularly reliable source.
No, but they
You're listening to Nature Bites Last on the Berkeley.
They do publish a lot of interesting stuff, Guy, and it tends to get a lot of reads. So, you know, it's a source of ideas. See, here's a very important distinction that needs to be drawn. There are four stages in scientific research. One is puzzlement. You have a phenomenon that you can't quite sort out or put together. The second is speculation. What are the alternative possible explanations? Third is adaptation. Look at the evidence, apply the principle of inference to the best explanation to figure out which is the best supported hypothesis, which makes it the preferable hypothesis among the alternatives, where when the evidence is settled down, more or less all points in the same direction, you're entitled to accept the preferable hypothesis as true in the tentative, infallible fashion of science, so that with the accumulation of more evidence, you may have to revise your hypothesis, reject some you previously accepted, accept some you previously rejected, and leave others in suspense, and where just because it is the best support, it is not a guarantee that it's true, but it is the conclusion most worthy of belief and acceptance because it is the best supported under the conditions I've just specified.
Right, we have another caller. Before that call, I want to point out that you're listening to Nature Bites Last on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm joined today by Jim Fetzer, Professor Emeritus from the University of Minnesota, Duluth. Dries from Philly, what do you got for us?
Guy, hey, Jim. Once again, it's a pleasure speaking with you. Appreciate all good work. But I had two questions in particular, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I want to kind of put this 9/11. I want to go back to 9/11. And sure. What Jim was kind of mentioning about 9/11, just kind of put this whole thing to bed, because I've been having multiple conversations with friends and people I know about the whole conspiracy piece. And I've been reading a lot about thermite, reports that traces of thermite were found at the site, at Ground Zero after, you know, 9/11 occurred. And so, and there's been, I've read this on more than one occasion. A lot of credible sources, it seems, credible sources have been reporting on the strong presence of thermite. And I believe, I looked that up, and I believe thermite's used for pyrotechnics, demolitions. I've listened to a lot of former military personnel experts speak about that, thermite's ability to be efficient in demolitions and explosives and pyrotechnics and things of that nature. So I just wanted to see if, Jim, if this question is kind of directed towards you, to see if what's your take on that, to kind of put this whole thing to bed, because for me that was a strong piece of evidence that supports that there was something going on. I mean, it seemed to point in the direction that it was orchestrated, that something happened, somebody had a hand in something that, you know, resulted in those towers collapsing. So I just wanted to kind of see if you had anything to...
I don't think there's any doubt about that. Stephen Jones, who is a professor of physics from BYU, became a co-chair of scholars at my invitation when I founded the organization in December of 2005. He became a strong advocate of the use of, well, what they call nanothermite, or a nano version of thermite. Thermite actually is an incendiary. It produces brilliantly bright light and intense heat. It's used to weld together railroad tracks, disable artillery pieces, drop a thermite grenade down the barrel of a howitzer, for example. It melts all of the firing mechanisms together, and it's no longer a useful piece of equipment. But it lacks the rapid gas expansion properties of explosives. And therefore, the claim that the Twin Towers could have been destroyed by thermite or nanothermite appears extremely implausible. In fact, I published three articles about nanothermite with a chemical engineer by the name of T. Mark Hightower. One is entitled, Is 9/11 Truth Based Upon a False Theory? A second is, Has nanothermite been oversold to the 9/11 truth community? And a third, nanothermite, if it doesn't fit, you must acquit. It turns out that for an explosive to be able to destroy a material, it has to have a detonation velocity equal to or greater than the speed of sound in that material. The speed of sound in steel is 6,200 meters per second, in concrete, 3,100 meters per second. But the highest attributed detonation velocity for nanothermite is only 895 meters per second, which means you can't get there from there. It doesn't have the capacity to destroy concrete or steel. Now, it may have been used in some capacity. For example, I believe it may have been used to create the cutouts in the facades because those weren't real planes that hit the north or the south tower. But after the dust cleared, there were these cutouts. I believe thermite may have been used for that. It's a fascinating story and a bit complex. I talk about it many places, including, for example, the Midwest 9/11 Truth Conference Part 2, which you can find on YouTube. The Midwest 9/11 Truth Conference Part 2, which you can find on YouTube, where I played explosive evidence from architects and engineers the first hour, and then I commented on it and went further the second. Now, the evidence for the nanothermite came from dust samples that were accumulated from an apartment in the vicinity of Ground Zero. What's interesting here is that the U.S. Geological Survey conducted far more extensive dust studies. They collected samples at 35 different locations around Manhattan, and they found a whole host of elements that would not have been present had this not been a nuclear event, including barium, strontium, uranium, lithium, lanthanum, tritium, some of which are inherently radioactive. In fact, we have some 70,000 first responders who've suffered from debilitating effects associated with exposure to ionizing radiation, such as multiple myeloma, lymphoma, pancreatic, and esophageal cancer. It's also very interesting that immediately after 9/11, Rudy Giuliani was able to line up 115 dump trucks to come into the area and start hauling away the debris from the buildings, even over the protests of the fire inspectors and other experts who knew that the site had to be studied to determine the cause of these events. I would say that in New York, to arrange to get a single dump truck would take you, an ordinary person, a month. Giuliani got 115, and what Judy Wood discerningly observed was not only were they taking out all this debris, but they were bringing in tons and tons and tons of dirt, so that these 115 dump trucks were coming into the site, which was actually growing. The debris pile was actually growing over time with the addition of all this vast quantity of dirt. Now, that's what the Soviets did when they dealt with the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. They brought in tons and tons and tons of dirt to help to absorb the radiation and the effects thereof. Well, that was going on at Ground Zero. The city, out of the kindness of its heart, by the way, replaced all the air conditioners in the city, or any that had had any exposure to the dust, which was, of course, voluminous because those two buildings were blowing apart from the top down. They were being converted into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust. When it was over, there was no massive pile of debris. Had they been collapses, there would have been like 14 or 15 floors of debris, but they were actually destroyed to or even below ground zero. Father Frank Morales from St. Mark's Episcopal Church, a first responder, came on my shows twice and made that crucial point. Compare that with Building 7, which came down in a classic controlled demolition. It was 47 floors. We know from experience with controlled demolitions, they leave a debris stack equal to 12% of the original. 12% of 47 is 5.5 floors, and indeed we have it. Indeed, in one of my favorite photographs, you're peering down at the location where Building 1 had stood, and in the background you can see the 5.5 floors from Building 7. But where Building Wood had stood, there's nothing because it was destroyed to or even below ground level. So these are all indications that was actually done with a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes. I have called out architects and engineers over this repeatedly. If they will maintain, well, something could have been used in addition to nanothermite to have performed the task, which nanothermite could not perform. So I asked them, well, after all these years, what is it? And after all these years, who was responsible and why? Neither architects and engineers nor Judy Wood and her Dew group are willing to address the question who was responsible and why, and neither of them give us an adequate answer to how it was done. I mean, the proper scientific attitude when you get new results like the U.S. Geological Survey dust study evidence is to take it into account and modify your hypotheses. Well, before the Vancouver hearings, which I organized in 2012, in May, I published a review of Judy Wood's book, Where Did the Towers Go? I gave it a 5-star review, but I mentioned in passing, because it was such a great compilation of photographs, documents, and records related to 9/11. But I mentioned in passing that it seemed to me that while she had ruled out large nukes, she'd not ruled out a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes. Well, during the Vancouver hearings, much, much more evidence was adduced confirming that it had been done with mini or micro nukes. When I came back to my review, I discovered there had been thousands, I'm talking literally thousands of attacks on my review by Judy Wood and her followers because I was contradicting what they regard as a sacred text where they have a mystical leader and a praetorian guard. In other words, this movement has the characteristics of a cult, which I pointed out on numerous occasions. It's not scientific to ignore the evidence and attack the messenger who presents the evidence thousands of times. In fact, if you go now today to my review, now this is not, these are not comments on Judy Wood's book. These are comments on my review of her book. There are more than 7,500 comments on my review of her book. The overwhelming majority are attacks on me, which is simply reflective of their unscientific attitude treating what is a scientific question as though it were an article of faith.
I want to follow up a little bit. A constant criticism of those who refuse to believe the 9/11 official report, which violates the laws of thermodynamics, is that any deviation from the official narrative represents a grand conspiracy that could not be maintained for long. And we hear this with respect to a lot of other issues as well, that there must be some sort of grand conspiracy that a lot of people are involved in, and it couldn't be maintained for long if that's the case. How do you deal with that response?
Guy, that's a common complaint. The CIA was introducing complaints like that in its original memorandum introducing the phrase conspiracy theorist. So it's not surprising, but we have projects like the Manhattan Project, the development of the atomic bomb that involved, I think, perhaps as many, if not 10,000, it might have been as many as 100,000 scientists and so forth. Everyone kept their mouths shut. When you're talking about 9/11, no one wants to talk because they're going to implicate others. But we have a vast amount of evidence about how it was done, who is responsible, and why. So I've given you these are 2-hour-long programs where I'm presenting all of the evidence in the course of demonstrating that all four of the 9/11 crash sites were fabricated or faked on the one hand. That's episode 100. And who was responsible and why on the other. That's episode 103. But let me point out that since none of those 9/11 aircraft crashed on 9/11, that means that no passengers aboard any of those planes died in air crashes that did not take place, which means that there were no suicide hijackers aboard them that caused them to crash, since none of them crashed. And indeed, as David Ray Griffin points out in his magisterial book, The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, as his very first point, a half a dozen or more of these alleged suicide jackers turned up alive and well the following day, many of whom made contact with the media in the United Kingdom. I mean, put two and two together. If the suicide hijackers survived, then they did not die in plane crashes they are alleged to have caused to crash. The American people have to be capable of this degree of logical competence, or we're doomed to be taken in plane for gullible saps by any story the government wants to float, which are becoming increasingly absurd by the day.
You know, I think you're pointing out that the American public might not be as discriminating and skeptical as it could be. I'm saying that with a profound sense of understatement.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, I think somehow the combined effects of fluoride, which, by the way, is an industrial waste that does damage to your health and even to your brain, of television, which has a soporific effect. Studies have shown that the level of mental engagement when you're watching television is lower than when you're in deep sleep, and of the endless propaganda from the government, where we've had a consolidation of the media now that began in the era of Ronald Reagan, when they gave up the 777 rule and the fairness doctrine, where the 777 rule was that no single company could own more than a combined 7 TV stations, 7 radio stations, 7 newspapers. Now we have Clear Channel, I believe, owns 1,200 radio stations, for example, last I looked, and where the government is controlling the media. I have demonstrated, for example, on my blog, jamesfetzer.blogspot.com, that the New York Times, no less, has published utter propaganda and nonsense about Sandy Hook. I prove it in my blog. That the Washington Post has done the same, published utter nonsense and rubbish about Sandy Hook. I prove it in my blog. That even, this is awful to me, the Chronicle of Higher Education has published completely meaningless rubbish and falsehoods about Sandy Hook. So if you go to my blog, jamesfetzer.blogspot.com, and just put in the New York Times, or jamesfetzer.blogspot.com and put in the Washington Post, or jamesfetzer.blogspot.com and put in the Chronicle of Higher Education, you will find the blogs where I prove this to be the case. And of course, everyone knows how the New York Times published page after page after page of fine details about the life of the Saranov brothers in Chechnya, how they were trained to be terrorists and all that. It's complete and utter rubbish. The New York, the Marathon bombing was a very superficial, amateurish drill. You had the police on bullhorns calling out, this is a drill, this is a drill. We had the Boston Globe tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities. A second tweet saying a bomb would be set off in 1 minute opposite the library. A minute later, one is set off opposite the Boston Public Library. There's smoke and noise, but I can assure you, as a former artillery officer in the Marine Corps, those were not serious explosions. They couldn't have killed anyone. If you look through the smoke, you see there are persons who are missing arms and legs, but there is no blood. As Lorraine Day, who is the chief of trauma surgery for San Francisco General Hospital for 25 years, has observed, that is a physiological impossibility. If those limbs had been blown off then and there, there would be massive, copious quantities of blood. It only shows up later, and it's bright red. It doesn't change color. It's Hollywood blood. It came out of tubes. Nathan Foulkes, who's a Hollywood producer, director, observed that one of the key players, a tall guy in a cowboy hat by the name of Carlos Arredondo, was an actor he'd featured in one of his own films, and was the first to suggest to me that the smoke actually hadn't come from explosives, but from a smoke machine. Well, in the Boston book, and nobody died in Boston either, we even have photographs of the smoke machine and of the containers where the blood came. I mean, that's why I subtitled that book, State-Sponsored Terrorism with Hollywood Special Effects. In the case of Sandy Hook, we have two chapters, 7 and 8, including 50 photographs of how they furnished the Lanza home, which appears to have been an empty house, in order to use it as a prop, and how they refurbished the school in order to it to serve as the stage. In relation to the school, we have photographs of the moving vans. We have the nameplate for the classroom with a moving tag still on it. We have the classic photographs of the SWAT team already there. Just above the vehicle, you can see a string of four windows in classroom 10 that would be claimed to be shot out after the event, but they're undamaged here. The flag is at full mast. There's a crime scene tape up for a crime that is yet to be committed. And there is Wayne Carver beneath a flag, leaning against a wall with his arms folded, awaiting the arrival of his portable mortuary tent. We have additional photographs showing the windows in classroom 10 before and after. The second from the left in particular is all shot out. We have another photograph of the perps drilling holes in the window frame to simulate bullet holes, and a fourth where pink rods have been inserted into the holes they've drilled to show the alleged trajectories. They're all exactly 90 degrees in relation to the window panes, and they're all perfectly parallel with one another. I used to supervise a marksmanship training at Edson Range, Camp Pendleton, when I was a series commander with 15 DIs and 300 recruits under my command. This is just preposterous. This is such obvious fabrication. I mean, it's outrageous that they thought they could get away with it. I don't believe they ever imagined in their wildest dreams that these photographs would get into the public domain. But we published 50 of them furnishing, rearranging the Adam Lanza home, and 50 more about the school in chapters 7 and 8 of the book. And nobody died in Sandy Hook, which Amazon.com banned, by the way, less than a month after it had been put up for sale. It had already sold nearly 500 copies. It blows apart the whole case. It includes, for example, an interview with Sophia Smallstorm of Paul Preston, who's the Los Angeles area superintendent of schools, who was so troubled by what he saw being broadcast from Newtown, having supervised some of these drills himself, that he reached out to his contacts in the Obama Department of Education, all of whom confirmed to him that it had been a drill, that no children had died, and that it was done to promote gun control.
In the United States, and to a lesser extent throughout the industrialized world, we have a culture that has been dumbed down for generations, and now we have cheap beer and television to seemingly complete the task. The whole situation seems hopeless. In the 1 minute we have left, why do you bother?
Well, I believe that if the American people know the truth, that they will know what should be done about it. I am a professional scholar. As a philosopher, I care about truth. As a philosopher of science, I know science is our most reliable method for discovering the truth. And as a former Marine Corps officer, I care about the future of our country. I'm doing everything I can with the rest of my life to expose these charades, these deceits and deceptions by the American government, because I believe that the American people deserve to know the truth about their own history.
Well, I must say you're considerably more optimistic than me. Thanks very much, Jim Fetzer, for joining us today.
Real pleasure, Guy.
Thank you. I do have a climate change update. For many years, scientists have cautioned that individual weather events could not be attributed to climate change. Now, however, specific extreme weather events can be attributed to climate change. A 200-page March 2016 report from the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine examines the current state of science of extreme weather attribution and identifies ways to move the science forward to improve those attribution capacities. I've added this information to feedback number 21. A paper published in the March 9th, 2016 issue of Nature Climate Change finds that we are on the verge of, quote, near-term acceleration in the rate of temperature change, end quote. In this case, near-term means by 2020. As indicated in the paper's abstract, quote, we find that present trends in greenhouse gas and aerosol emissions are now moving the Earth system into a regime in terms of multi-decadal rates of change that are unprecedented for at least the past 1,000 years, end quote. For the first time, scientists have investigated the net balance of the three major greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide, for every region of Earth's land masses. The results were published in the March 10, 2016 issue of Nature. The surprising result? Human-induced emissions of methane and nitrous oxide from ecosystems overwhelmingly surpass the ability of the land to soak up carbon dioxide emissions, which makes the terrestrial biosphere a contributor to climate change. I've added this information to feedback number 22. Geoengineers will not be able to do away with rising seas, according to a paper published in the March 10, 2016 issue of Earth System Dynamics. The proposed approach of pumping water from the sea and storing it as ice on the continent of Antarctica will not delay sea level rise. Rather, unless the seawater is pumped enormous distances at tremendous energy cost, the strategy will only accelerate the flow of the glaciers, and it will all end up back in the sea again. Gee, what a surprise. There's much more, too. The avalanche of bad news on the climate change front continues unabated. It's crazy busy today here at the Mud Hut, so I'll try to catch up with the latest information on next week's show. That about wraps up this week. Be sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. Please feel free to post questions you'd like us to address on the show. Continue to follow my work at the blog, GuyMcPherson.com, for further essays, updates, and speaking tours. We'll see you on the radio next Tuesday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern. We'll be interviewing Alma and Boo, two locals who went back to the land decades ago. If you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at prn.fm or at Stitcher, and rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to our guest, Jim Fetzer, as well as to our listeners and those who called in. Thanks also to Afrozen for the music. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end, nature bats last.
Mother Nature. Mother Nature.